Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. Today I'm flying solo. Tony is busy trying to drum up some business for the Tortoise Shack. And I'd just like to remind everybody, these pods cost to produce, they cost to put out there. So look, come on board, become a patron at patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Now on to the more interesting story of the day. I have with me Professor John Wenger. Now, John is a professor of chemistry at UCC, specializing in atmospheric chemistry, air quality, and climate change. Thanks for joining us this morning, John.
Good morning. How are you?
Not too bad. John, will you explain to us exactly what it means, a professor of, I suppose the best way to say, of aerosol, of how these things work?
Okay, so as you kind of intimated there, I'm a professor in chemistry and I study atmospheric chemistry and air quality. One of the main things that we focus on is aerosols. So these are tiny suspended particles in the air. They come from a variety of sources like burning coal or wood or peat, traffic, and other things. And once they're in the air, they can have two effects. They affect the climate, but they also affect the health. So they can be breathed in and they can affect respiratory health, they can affect the function of the heart, and in fact, exposure to fine particles in air accounts for over 1,000 premature deaths per year in Ireland alone. So it's a very serious health effect associated with particles. And so over the years now, we have done lots of research on these particles, and when they're suspended in air, we call them aerosols, and we work at their sources, and maybe provide advice on how to reduce the sources of these particles to have a positive outcome for health and maybe for climate too.
Now, I'll just point out, John, you're not a health expert, but the issue of aerosol, particularly with the coronavirus, has come to the fore, and you are absolutely an expert on aerosol. Can you tell us the intersection of these two things, of COVID-19 and aerosol, why that's important to us?
Well, it's important because the aerosol can be inhaled into the respiratory system, and that's a way of transmitting the disease. You know, it is a recognized mode of transmission for respiratory illnesses. I mean, you've heard a lot about droplets, which are exhaled at short range, and this is the close contact transmission of the disease. And that's why we have the spacing, the 2 meter spacing. The idea is that somebody coughing or sneezing, these droplets that are emitted could carry the virus. And that could be then taken or breathed in. If you also think about these virus particles falling onto a surface, they could contaminate the surface. Somebody else could come along and touch it, okay, and therefore pick up the virus by transferring their hand, for example, to the mouth or the nose. And so those are the major points that were put forward by the WHO, the major modes of transmission. But we also know that respiratory illnesses can be transmitted through the air, through what we call aerosol transmission. And the difference between aerosol and droplet here is a little bit fuzzy. And in fact, the WHO, I don't really think, have properly communicated this very well. And as a result of that, a team of aerosol scientists, not really a team, a large group of aerosol scientists, and many with greater expertise than me, especially in the area of infectious diseases, realized that the WHO is really kind of not taken on board the idea of aerosol transmission seriously. And so, as reported about a month ago now, there was a large group of scientists, over 200 of us, signed a letter requesting that the WHO and the other international bodies to seriously look at this and therefore to maybe update advice on measures to prevent transmission by considering aerosol as an important pathway for transmission.
Is there any indication that aerosol of COVID-19 can stay in an enclosed space for longer, we'll say, than a droplet is? The notion with a droplet is you cough, it goes a certain distance, and it drops, whereas an aerosol works differently. Am I right about that, John?
That's right. The aerosol contains particles which are much smaller. You can't see them. They are about a hundredth of the size of a human hair, okay? So they're that small. or a grain of sand, so they're tiny. And because they're so small, they behave a bit more like gas molecules, and so they can float through the air. Okay, so rather than being sort of visible, I know, bits of spit or something that might come out when somebody coughs or sneezes, these are really much smaller than that. And as a result, they can get carried around in airflows in the room. Okay, and we know this. I mean, this is well known. And this is aerosol physics. If you look at the size of particles that are released when people cough and sneeze, but also when they're talking, when they're singing, these are 1 micron in size. That's a thousandth of a millimeter. Okay, you can't see them, but they are going into the air all the time, and they can move around, and over time, over minutes, they can fill a room, in fact. So this was the idea. It's not just distancing that's important. What we think is also important is that people need to think about being in an enclosed space. These virus-containing particles could build up in concentration. And if you're there for a long time, your exposure could be really quite high. And there are instances reported of these kind of famous super spreader events, you know, the choir practice in the USA, where yes, something like 80% of people actually caught the coronavirus through one infected person. And it was 2.5 hours in an enclosed space with poor ventilation where people were singing. And so even whilst they were trying to do some social distancing, this huge infection rate can only really be explained by transport of the virus in the air and everybody breathing in that air and becoming infected. We've also had other cases, famous restaurants in China, buses, and so on. And of course, now we have issues with meat plants, so which are likely, again, due to crowded environments where there's poor ventilation or recirculated air, maybe in the case of meat plants. And the idea is that the concentration of the virus can build up over time. We get a higher exposure, and that's when we become infected.
And you've mentioned ventilation, John, as important in this. Is it important to take that air out of the room, to be constantly bringing in fresh air into an enclosed space?
Yes, that's crucial, especially in a small room or a crowded room. It doesn't have to be small. If it's crowded, we have lots of people breathing out. I mean, you can imagine a crowded classroom with 20 or 30 children in it and a teacher, and the windows closed, it gets really stuffy.
Yes.
And that's because all the exhaled air just builds up in that room. And if you just simply open the windows, open the door, you'll get fresh air passing through and diluting that exhaled air. If that exhaled air contains the virus, you will then dilute the virus and you will reduce exposure in that case. So ventilation is really, really important. That is not emphasized enough because there's not due recognition of the role of aerosols in transmitting this virus.
Would that also explain why airplanes are hotbeds for infection?
This is a bit more tricky. It's not clear that airplanes are more hotbeds for infection. In fact, airplanes have very good air filtering systems. They have what is called HEPA filters, or high efficiency particulate air filters, and they have a large number of air changes per hour. So in fact, they have some of the best air cleaning facilities going. You know, the air is taken in, of course, it's in the cabin, but it is recirculated, but it's filtered using a very, very high performance filter. And so the chances of contacting an aeroplane are not necessarily that high. I think a more crowded space might well be boarding the aircraft or sitting on the aircraft if the HEPA filter is not working, maybe before it takes off.
Yes.
But I think they've probably changed recommendations on that. I mean, the airline industry really do have very good air filtration systems. I think are probably fine. I would get on a plane. I'd probably wear a mask. But I'm not so sure I'd get on a bus, or a train, or especially without a mask. I mean, you really would need some kind of protection there for you and for others.
What kind of, I mean, we see airplanes have a very good system of recycling the air. What about, we'll say, for instance, crowded settings, an office, a school? These places typically don't have, particularly with our weather, we don't have air filtration systems. We don't have ventilation. What can we do to make these places safer?
Well, very simply is open the doors and windows. Now, of course, this might be easier to do now and even in September maybe, but as we go through into the winter, this becomes difficult because we lose heat and so on. But I think it's really important that we still do that. And also to, if there is air conditioning, it needs to have outside air. Okay, recirculating air that is not filtered can only just recirculate virus-containing air. And that obviously is not good.
Where aerosol is concerned, is there a safe distance? Or if you're in the room, are you susceptible to it? That's just it. You're in the room.
If you were to make some measurements of the particles or even CO2 that somebody breathes out, you move a distance away and it becomes less and less and less. You get dispersion of the particulate. Okay. Now, if there's absolutely no ventilation, all of the CO2 and the particulates will stay in the air. The particulates can deposit over time. Okay. But it is important to have some ventilation for sure to dilute that. Especially if you have 20 or 30 people in a room breathing, then concentrations of CO2 and particles could rise quite quickly. So it's important to monitor that and to regulate that. And my fear is that, especially when it comes to schools, this information hasn't been really put up front from the Department of Education, the guidelines. There's a lot of emphasis on cleaning and so on, but very little on ventilation.
I would think it pretty difficult to install a ventilation system into particularly urban schools, which are quite big campuses. You know, it's a big space. But how do they get to put in ventilation systems? I think we have something like 16 days before schools reopen. It is a concern.
It is, but you know, it might be unrealistic to expect, you know, to put in the ventilation systems in especially old schools. The infrastructure is poor in many cases. And, you know, I do think simple ventilation is a key here. I mean, I've been taking advice from the Harvard School of Public Health, who have published excellent documents on what measures schools can do and local authorities can do about returning to school. And one of the key things that they say is that is natural ventilation as much as possible, but maybe to measure the extent of ventilation by using a simple CO2 monitor, carbon dioxide monitor. Okay, so outdoor air typically has about 415, 420 parts per million of CO2. I think many of your listeners will be aware of these sorts of numbers, okay, from climate change. But in an indoor environment where people are breathing out, it can rise and rise and rise. And indications are that if you are above 800 parts per million, that's double the outdoor concentration, then you need to ventilate. So I think a simple way is to have a CO2 monitor in your classroom or your workplace and see the level that it's at. And if it rises above 800 or double the outside concentration, then ventilate or get out of the room.
That's a very simple rule of thumb, John. You're not looking at huge expense to do something like that. That's affordable for schools to do. And it seems like a very sensible idea. If you just measure the CO2 levels, you'll have an indication of the aerosol levels. It seems very simple.
I think so. Plus also, I think that the schools will have plans in place to ventilate, or they should have plans in place to ventilate between classes, first thing in the morning and so on. So ventilate as much as possible, especially between classes. If it's the depths of winter and it's cold, I think they still need to open the doors and windows to ventilate between classes. And I think that, you know, when the children return to school and are wearing masks, I think that regular mask breaks are also vital for both the teachers and the students, you know, because it's quite stuffy, quite hot, and the environment inside and wearing masks. You know, I think after about an hour of that, you've had enough, right? So you probably want to get up and go for a walk around, walk outside, have a 5-minute mask break with the class, and then go back inside. And then you can ventilate during that period too, right?
Yes.
With the door open and the windows open.
Our masks, I mean, there is I'm not a proponent of not wearing masks. I think we should all be wearing masks as much as possible. Is that any protection to aerosol, the aerosolation of COVID, or the of any particles? As we'll take it away from COVID, any particles at all?
So masks are, so say for example a surgical mask. It's a very good filter for exhaled particles. It's three layers. It absorbs and it traps exhaled particles, not 100%, but probably around about 70 or 80%. Okay. Now, the homemade masks or the reusable masks, it depends how they're made. But one of the key things, of course, is how well they are fitted. And some people don't wear them properly. We've seen that. Okay. But if they are worn properly, they do reduce the emission of any virus containing particles or aerosols into droplets, also into the air, and so this will then protect others. They can also filter out some particulates that you're breathing in, so they do have some effect for the user too, some benefit for the user too. Now that is harder to quantify, and it's not as efficient as the trapping from exhaled air. But even though I think that if everybody wears a mask, I think that there's a societal benefit, there's a group benefit for sure. For example, in a classroom.
The letter you and 200 experts wrote to the WHO, have the WHO changed guidelines or responded in any way to that letter?
Quite quickly, they updated some details regarding ventilation. They acknowledged that aerosol transmission could take place in certain settings. And those settings are crowded indoor environments where it is also poorly ventilated. And this is absolutely true. They didn't go beyond that very much. Now, the Center, European Center for Disease Prevention and Control, where the Department of Education, for example, is taking its advice from, and I presume and most of the public health experts are taking their advice from too, does really recognize that ventilation is important. They provided guidelines on that, and they said that certain workplaces, certain settings where there are groups of people, in addition to distancing, mask wearing would be beneficial, but also ventilation too. And I see in the Department of Education guidelines that huge, the word cleaning is mentioned, I don't know, 50 times, 100 times, but the word ventilation is hardly mentioned at all. And this is something that schools can do for free, and workplaces too, you know. I've been trying to get this out there. I think it's important. I mean, even if aerosol transmission isn't the most dominant route, even if it's only 10%, you know, we should still adopt the precautionary principle here and do whatever we can to protect ourselves from spreading the virus.
I have to agree with you there, Johnny. I mean, it's not one silver bullet that solves everything. It's as they say, a suite of measures. And dealing with aerosol has to be part of that suite of measures. If they're going to spend so much time and effort in cleaning, filtering your air or cleaning your air is also cleaning. It's just non-visible cleaning. I think opening doors, whatever, is very important. But much better still if you could pump the air out and pump fresh air in and have a constant flow, and then you'll never get a rise above the 400. With a bit of luck, you'll never get a rise above the 400.
That's right. I was talking, the 400 is ambient. If you get up to about 800, I think it's going to be hard to not rise above 400, but you want to make sure you don't get to what could be deemed as potentially unhealthy levels, right? Certainly, as you go above 1,000 or 1,200, there are known effects of CO2 on concentration and so on. You know, people get a bit tired and they can't concentrate so well. So it does affect cognitive function, as it's called. So it's just good indoor air quality control. And one thing I forgot to mention is that lots of schools in the USA are talking about doing this now. They're talking about buying basically an air purifier. So we're not talking about kitting out schools with complicated ventilation systems. And it may not come to this, right? But, you know, there is certainly talk in the US where obviously it's a very quite a volatile situation at the moment. But they are talking about using air purifiers that have a HEPA filter on them. So Rob mentioned earlier on about the high quality air filtering that goes on in the aircraft. You could have that in the classroom. Now, the cost of that may be something like €500 per classroom. But hey, what's the cost of, I don't know, school closing down and then you lock down a whole county? What's the cost of that?
Yeah, it's economies of scale. You know, we have to spend, if we want things to return as normal as possible, then we're going to have to put the outlay out there first. And 500 per classroom, while it sounds a lot, it's not exorbitant for the situation we are in. And indeed, I just say we've all been in a classroom where it has become CO2 heavy and we have yawned and we have leaned on our arms. This is not anything unusual for everybody who has ever gone to school to experience that. But that is the danger point with the aerosolation of COVID-19. When you're at that point, it probably means the air is fairly laden with aerosol.
Yes. And it's time to ventilate or get out. If you can't ventilate properly, just take some fresh air and ventilate the room and then come back later. I have two teenagers, right? So, and I contacted the local schools and I went to see them. And in fact, I was presently surprised, not really surprised, but I was pleased to see, right, that they were actually on the ball. You know, they had good plans in place. They were aware of ventilation. Now I did get in touch with them beforehand to say this, but they were on the ball. So I mean, I think it is a very big task for all the teachers and principals to set these systems up in place where we would really reducing the risk of transmission in the school with young children. It's difficult. Groups of children moving around, 500 to 1,000 children in a school. You know, it's stressful enough. I mean, this is adding extra stress. And I think that the department really should provide better support to enable them to provide the right environment for the children going back. And it's not just the physical measures. I think it's the organizational side of things as well, the logistics. I think teachers are looking at schedules and moving classes and staggering breaks and all these sorts of things. I think a lot of them are just getting on with it, but I think more help should be given to each of these schools.
John, when a classroom does become, we'll say, laden with aerosol, if that class moves out and a half hour later another class moves in, is that air still actively full of aerosol?
Potentially, it depends upon the ventilation rate. So my advice would be any changeover, completely ventilate the room.
And is there a typical time frame that would take if you open doors and windows? It depends on the room, depends on the door, I presume.
Depends on the room, depends on the number of people that were in it, and so on. The air flows within the room. And I think that's why a simple monitor might be a very good idea in many cases, especially if schools or teachers think that they do have areas of their buildings where airflow is not sufficient, if ventilation is not sufficient, it would be worth monitoring. I mean, I bought a simple CO2 monitor for €150. It's handheld, it's on batteries, you can take it wherever you want, and it gives you a reading within a minute. I think simple things like this can be done, but the information is just not getting out there to the schools.
And you believe this should be a major part of the conversation about reopening schools?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I've been reading around a bit more, and I know the key things are the level of transmission of the virus within the community is a key thing. If the you need to have a very low transmission or a low enough transmission rate for the schools to open in the first place, and so I think that was. For example, Kildare Shoffley recently, I think it's very important that, you know, we work to get those number of cases down so that transmission rate within the community is low enough for schools to reopen. not safely, everybody uses the word safely, but with the minimum risk. Okay,
yeah, because it isn't actually safely. It is within acceptable risk limits, I think is a better phrase to use.
And in the end, the idea of opening schools is really important for many reasons, for education of the children, but also their mental health, well-being, and so on. And you know, it maybe helps the parents too. But you know, it's a risk-benefit analysis here. The benefits of reopening, there's always going to be a risk, okay, about reopening schools, and we are going to get cases. You know, I mean, touch wood that we don't get anything too serious. There is, you know, thankfully there are indications that children, although they can transmit the disease, they don't become their symptoms don't become too severe generally. So that is good to know. But they still can transmit. So if they return home, they can transmit to family members and so on. And that's the way things can spread, obviously. But once we've got low enough transmission, then I think that opening the schools with minimum risk is really, really important. But the teachers and the schools need to have as much information as possible and as much help as possible to do this from the department.
Is there a temperature element in this, John? If a room is colder or hotter, does it slow or increase the aerosolation within the room?
This is quite complicated. So environmental factors like temperature, like relative humidity, do influence the lifetime and the viability of the virus. At lower temperatures, the virus is more stable. So if you are at low temperatures, for example, in a chilled factory that is using chilled air, then it will last a bit longer than, say, in a room typical room temperature of 20 degrees. If you have relative humidity, ideally you want to have relative humidity in the range 40 to 60%. Again, if you go to low relative humidity, you can increase the lifetime of the virus. So normal room temperature and normal humidity in the range 40 to 60 degrees is what we should aim for.
Okay. So it doesn't mean that we have to have classrooms either freezing cold or overly warm. Just normal room temperature with good ventilation should be adequate.
Indeed.
John, is there anything else that we need to know about aerosols, we'll say, outside of workplaces? Is it any more prevalent, we'll say, if one is doing sport? A choir, we have seen that, you know, people singing, that increased the aerosolation in a room. But in an open area, you know, people playing sport, are they more at risk because they're breathing out more, they're heavier breathing? Or is outside just better?
Outside is obviously much better. We have lots of ventilation outside. Obviously, you know, the winds can carry virus away. I mean, I think is outdoors is not to have face-to-face conversation for, you know, an extended period of time. It's to still distance yourself, even outdoors. I think that's important. And you know, playing sport. I'm a soccer coach, so you know, we've gone back to playing soccer, and you know, GAA teams are back and so on. So, I think outdoor sport is essential. Again, it's one of these things where we've got to balance up a benefit and a risk. You know, the value of sport and exercise for people is obviously very high, and the risk is low. So, I think it's a great one to do. Now, indoor environment, I think if the good ventilation is okay. So, for example, if you've got a gym hall and you've got good ventilation, then I think I think it would be okay. You know, I think it's important to have good ventilation. And I think especially in a fast-moving contact sport, say, for example, like basketball, these points where players are meeting each other are very transient. So there's very little opportunity to transmit the disease in that case. It's only if people are sitting close together or standing close together for a long period of time, you really increase the opportunity for transmission there. Especially exposure is the amount times time, right? So the longer you are in this environment, the higher exposure you're going to have.
Are you happy that you went and checked out with your children's school that they are going to be using ventilation? And should more of us be picking up the phone and saying, just in what way is the ventilation going to be in the school?
Well, I'm happy I did it. You know, I'm aware that the principals knew I was active in communicating well, my opinion and hopefully advice on this. So I think they half expected me to contact them, and in fact, they were going to contact me anyway. Now, should we all phone up the teachers and the principals? I don't know. But I think it would be more efficient way would be for the department to do that and to provide support in ensuring ventilation. I don't know, some budget for ventilation.
They've
got a budget for cleaning, right? So why not a budget for ventilation?
Well, I think that makes sense, John. Once you put a budget there, the budget does tend to get spent. So right. I think that makes very good sense, is to have an allocated amount for ventilation. Yeah. Professor, thank you so much for coming on and having this chat. I mean, I think it's a very, very timely and important chat to have. And I think that the very fact that the WHO has altered guidelines and is listening to the experts means that we should too be listening to the experts. This is not left field stuff. This is proper science explained to us by a proper scientist. And thank you very much for that, Professor.
You're welcome.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.